it's for you and me. So it's time we take a ride. We can cast our lips over the south side while we fly right over the love field sea. Look up ahead.
From somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Ever try to wonder out how brain cells work? That's just one of the things we'll talk about with our guest David Bodanis. And also, he's written a book called E equals MC squared. We'll find out about that too. Lots to talk with him about. I might have to keep him for 8 hours. He's probably cringing right now. I'm only kidding, David. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, David Bodanis, our guest. David, so many things to talk about with electricity and the minds and the inventions that really were created because of it. You know what fascinates me, though, is what will things be like with electricity 100 years from now? Have you ever been able to think about that?
It's hard to tell. I sometimes think one of the frontiers will be inside the human body. Most of us don't think of electricity as working inside the body. We think, like, you know, the body's wet. And electricity is like crackling and sparkling, and you know, and near the twain shall meet. You know who I blame for that? I blame Bond, James Bond. You know, do you remember one of the movies where there was like this bad guy in a bathtub and he threw the radio in? You know, the guy started getting all sizzling, and Bond said, "Shocking." You know,
yes.
So that makes us. That's why a lot of people don't think of electricity inside the body.
Was that Jaws, the guy with the teeth?
Oh, was it? I think he zapped. Yeah, he zapped him with electricity. They use electricity a lot. Remember, Odd Job also got it inside Fort Knox.
Yeah.
So, but we think of, like, the body is wet and squishy, and electricity is, like, I don't know, like, dry and macho or something. But it turns out, I finished Electric Universe with a bunch of chapters on electricity inside the body, and I kind of think that's the final frontier. Many of us, if there's time, we can talk about how brain cells and body cells work with electricity.
Absolutely, because, you know, now I was fascinated. A few weeks ago, David, I had a story about a person. He's paraplegic, confined, obviously, to his wheelchair, and he was able, he's got a chip in his brain, and he's able now to think thoughts. Now, keep this in mind. He's not connected to a wire or anything here. He's able to think thoughts, and he can turn on his television. He can, you know, make the volume go higher or lower. He's able to move the cursor on a computer, basically, by thinking thoughts. And that's in our technology today. I'm telling you, 100 years from now, assuming humans survive, we're going to be able to do remarkable things. I think, for example, you know how on a cell phone we're all talking back and forth. You know, here you are right now, by the way. You're in London. I'm here in Los Angeles. I think in 100 years, you and I can carry on a conversation and we'll think it to each other because we'll have chips in our head.
Well, I mean, yeah, at the moment, you know, like you were saying, if you walk down the street and you see somebody has a hands-free, you know, telephone, and it, even for us in a very technologically advanced society, it's sort of startling to see them. They're talking, and we barely notice this thing. Now, at the moment, those little telephones, like they wrap around your ear or something, right? Well, suppose they're actually implanted inside your ear.
Exactly.
Well, then, you know, the boundary between the body and the not the boundary body, already you get that with eyeglasses.
And they'll be smaller. Maybe they'll be the size of, you know, of a little tiny pill that you take or something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, suppose if you put glasses, you know, you rest them on your nose, clearly it's an external machine. You're using this machine called eyeglasses. But suppose instead you get corrective surgery on your eye. Or maybe in the future there's a way that by squeezing your, you know, just blinking in different ways, you can make the corrective surgery around your eyes have slight telephoto, slight microscopic, right? So it's like putting the eyeglass inside. So there's going to be more of those boundary breakings where you break that boundary. The reason that guy that you mentioned gets the wonders of being able to think and have stuff respond is entirely because the brain actually works by electricity. If you look inside the brain, there's about 100 billion nerve cells. Each one looks like a very, very, very thin strand of spaghetti. What's really weird is there's just about almost exactly as many nerve cells inside the brain as there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. For me, that's like, whoa, I think it's coincidence, but it's really, really wonderful, you know? You sometimes wonder if the whole galaxy is alive. But anyways, inside our brain, there's these tiny little nerve cells, these little like strands moving along, and the way that they carry signals is by electricity, little electric charges. not electrons, but things bigger than electrons, are going in and out of the cells all the time, and it's sort of like gunpowder going down like, you know, a fuse in those old movies. The electricity just goes, zips along one of these nerves and comes to the very end of the nerve, and it can't jump the gap. And then there's another nerve. You know that famous picture of on the Sistine Chapel of God stretching his finger out to Adam, but he doesn't quite touch?
Right.
Well, it turns out what crosses the gap. And in the book, I describe how people worked out what crosses the gap. And by understanding that, what crosses the gap, people have been able to make all sorts of drugs that control the links between nerves in the brain or between nerves and muscles in our body. So you get things like Viagra and Prozac and all sorts of things just by slightly adjusting what jumps the gap. So in your brain all the time, there's these, you know, these shooting flickers of electricity go across the nerve, come to the edge, and then they send out this tiny little molecule. It looks like a miniature submarine that just sort of floats across, bum-ba-dum-ba-dum, floats across the gap, touches the nerve on the other side, and triggers a shooting impulse there. And that's happening in all directions all the time. And some of them are just sort of quivering back and forth, and we can't access it. And those could be, I don't know, memories of, I don't know, your first kiss or all sorts of things. And then sometimes, you know, other electrical signals reach down, and then they open up that area, and those memories come shooting back to us.
Well, when we talk about electricity, do you know what EVP is? Electronic voice phenomena.
What is that?
People have recorded electronically with their tape recorders voices from the other side. They can only do it electronically. You can't hear it with your ear. But once you play a tape recorder, they've heard these incredible ghost sounds, David. Now, let's assume they're true for a moment, and I think a lot of them are, because some of these sounds, I mean, are absolutely staggering. They'll go into a prison, for example, and they'll turn on their machines, and they'll go back and listen to their tapes, and they'll hear people who are on death rows, you know, things like, you know, I did it. Little things like that. And these people, you know, some of them I think are perpetrating a hoax, but not all of them. Some of these sounds are actually real. So there's some kind of electronic thing involved here with electricity and the other side, the other dimension, wherever it is. That fascinates me because that tells me that the connection between the physical and the non-physical is electric. And if these voices are indeed real and we're able to pick them up electronically, there's something there that we just are beginning to tap into and we really don't even understand yet.
Well, without going into the details of that, one thing that that sort of may be useful in understanding it is that sound waves, they actually die away. Like if you speak in a big room or, you know, you get these echoes back and forth, after a while the sound wave, that's a shaking of the air. And the air shakes, and after a while it gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, and it doesn't keep on getting dimmer forever. It isn't like 10 years later you can still hear the sound echoes. They just become random movement of the air. You can't hear it anymore. It's sort of like if you put your hand in a pond and shake it, you know, the pond ripples, but like, I don't know, 5 minutes later, the ripples are actually gone. There's just random movement of the water. But electricity, you are right. At least, you know, electricity is different. Electromagnetic waves, when you start them, unless they go into a big sheet of metal where they'll actually get stuck, so to say, or get dissipated, they can actually go on forever.
They go on forever, as a matter of fact.
You can see, yeah. Without going into the details of what you're saying, I can sort of up it with something that all scientists would agree with, which is not very well known, but which is pretty exciting, which is, again, talk about things you can pick up from electricity. I'm going to mention this, and it's going to sound like it's not true, but it really is. You know, like in the old TV stations where you would change from, like, one channel to the other and stuff, and you sometimes see some static between the stations?
Yeah.
Or sometimes on radio, if you're switching a radio station manually and you hear some static and stuff. But go back to the TV one where you sometimes see that snowy static. A certain amount of what you're seeing is actually the Big Bang. You're actually seeing the creation of the universe from 13.5 billion years ago. The reason is when the universe exploded, like that, there was an incredible, I mean, a seriously massive explosion.
What? We had a sound. They created a sound of that explosion, and it was weird.
Yeah, so there are sound waves in a sense, but those are extremely low frequency. I mean, it's hard to call them sound, but there are physical vibrations. But there's also these electromagnetic waves that occurred at that time, and because the universe was very hot then, and it's been cooling down ever since. And these cooling waves are now just about 2 or 3 degrees above absolute zero. But you can measure them with the right equipment. They pervade the universe so much. It's just a kind of a dim leftover of that blast. There was a great Russian physicist called Andrei Sakharov. I think he got the Nobel Prize. He was a physicist
sure
and
did.
He worked for peace and stuff. And his wife really supported him when he was, you know, detained by the Soviet government and when they were in poverty during the war and all sorts of stuff. She was really supportive. And one time he looked at her and he said, "My dear, do you know what I love most of all? Most of all, most of all." And she looked at him and said, "Andre, tell me, what do you love most of all?" And she thought, I don't know, he would say something like, "Remember when I kissed you in the moonlight, or your hand on my shoulder," or something. He said, "What I love is residual cosmic radiation from the Big Bang." And she said, "That's my Andre." That's what he was like. But isn't that neat? It's actually been floating around all this time, and little fragments go in and we can hear them. The static on radio stations, between stations, some of that is just random stuff from inside your radio, but some of it is lightning storms on the planet Jupiter, which are just exploding out there and swirl across space and stuff and reach Earth and go around. Do you know what else I find kind of neat? If you're not listening to it at that moment, it's gone forever. There's images from distant stars which, I don't know, like, you know, burst out at a particular moment, and if you happen not to look at them in the sky that night, they've traveled all that way, the millions and millions and millions of miles to Earth, further than that even, and then they go past the clouds layers, and they go right past your eyes, but you're not looking up, and like maybe they impact on your closed eyelid, and then their journey of billions or trillions of miles, it's ended. It's like you race across somewhere to give somebody a message, and they're not in. Oh, you just leave it at the door. So it really shows that it's really nice to be attentive, to be aware of what's going. That ties in, I suppose, a little bit with Einstein. He was actually very modest. He was highly aware that there were things that that couldn't have been explained when he was young that became vivid later, the notion that ordinary mass can explode into energy. So he didn't believe in everything. He wasn't gullible, but he was very modest about what we know. He would never say we know everything right now.
I've got to talk with you about your book E equals MC squared in the next half hour, because that has always fascinated me.
Neat stuff.
What a mind he has. So, all right, let's assume then that this force that's out there in the universe, the electric universe, is doing these incredible things. I think, for example, when people can have telepathy between people, I think what they do is their electrically charged mind, their brain, somehow sends a transmission like a radio would, as a transmitter would, as we are to a satellite, to everybody who's listening today, that you can actually transmit your thoughts to people, and it's that electric universe that allows you to do it. Do you like that theory?
Well, it's exactly the period of time when belief in telepathy became really popular. There were two times when it became popular, and one of them was the early 1920s. And the reason is, a huge number of people had died in the First World War, and there are a lot of people who would give anything to contact, you know, brothers and sons and stuff. But also, it was around that time that people first got these boxes you could put in your living room, and it was a music box or a radio box, and you would actually, it was the first, you know, commercial radios were entering into homes, and people did exactly as you described. They would turn on these knobs, and they would find that they had thought air was empty, but in fact there were these invisible signals being transmitted, in this case from, you know, big transmitting stations in the big cities, and they could be picked up in these boxes. And so they thought, wow, this had been going on all the time, and we were unable to pick it up before. So what else is going there, possibly on a weaker level that we can't pick up?
Well, and like a radio program, if somebody isn't dialing the right frequency on their radio, they're not going to pick up the show. I think people can communicate with each other and do incredible things if you finally find out what frequency both of you are on. That's my theory. I'm your next book, David.
Okay, we will be there.
The stories that you encountered when you were writing this book, Electric Universe, of all of them, which one just fascinated you the most?
Oh, it had to be the Alexander Graham Bell. he was, I was writing it at a difficult time. I was, I had the misfortune to get divorced about 3 years ago. And it's since then, everything's worked out okay. But at the time, I was not a happy camper. And I really, really wanted to believe, I didn't want to become bitter and twisted. I really wanted to believe that love could conquer all, that there really was a second chance for everybody. So I was hunting through in the early planning for electricity, and I found a love story. I found a story of where true love genuinely led to, you know, obstacles were overcome, and it led to happiness and a great discovery, which transformed mankind for the better. And I latched onto that story. I said, oh, God, yes. And then through writing it, I sort of pulled myself out of this trough of despondency. And by the time I finished that chapter, I thought, okay, my life isn't perfect, but at least I know that there's hope.
And remember my favorite saying, these are things of tongue and pen, the saddest of which what might have been.
Mm.
You know, that says you just
move on. Yeah, because what happened with the telephone is that there's this young, I'll just mention the story briefly, and then later this time we can do it more, but I'd love to get to Einstein later, because he's really
Yeah,
cool.
we'll devote the whole half hour to him.
Oh, cool.
And then the third hour, you know you're with me 3 hours, we're going to take phone calls the third hour.
Oh, that'll be neat.
Have you ever done a three-hour interview before, straight like this?
No, but my kids, who are great and have just gone off to school, they've left their dad all sorts of nutritious supplies.
Excellent.
Plus ridiculous little diagrams, drawings, and sketches.
You just sit back and you're not going anywhere. Okay, but go ahead with the, Bell story.
So what happened is we think of Alexander Graham Bell as one of those boring dead white males, you know, with embarrassing facial hair. You see the picture in a book of this old guy with a big beard. But when he was in his 20s, he was a Scottish immigrant to America, and he was a teacher of the deaf. His mother had been deaf, so he knew about that sort of stuff. And he was in Boston, Massachusetts, and there was a student in his class. He was in his 20s, and she was just under 20. And they had this very tremulous relationship. They never said they were in love, but he was teaching the class how to recognize, you know, that when you speak, because some of them had partial hearing or they were developing speaking, and that you know, your throat vibrates. And so he would put his hand on their throat, or they would put their fingers on his throat, and you could actually feel the vibration of, you know, different sounds.
Yeah.
And she could still speak a little bit. She had lost her hearing when she was, I think, 4 or 5 from rheumatic fever. And he said to her, "You have a lovely voice." And she wrote later in a journal, "Nobody had ever said that to me." So they had this sweet, sweet thing.
Sure.
And sometimes it's even most intense when you don't even say you're in love. But anyways, there was one problem. Her family owned much of Boston, Mass. They were incredibly
wealthy. Why is that a problem?
Well, he went to Nantucket, where they had a big house on the island, and he banged on the door. You know, there was a rainstorm and lightning storm, and he declared to the mother, he said, "I love your daughter. I want to meet her and court her." And the mother said, "Look, we don't want another gold digger. Our family's been harassed by people like you for plenty of times. She's not interested in you. Go away.
He didn't make the cut with them, did he?
Exactly. So he went back to his hotel on the island, and I found the letters he wrote that evening. And he thought, if I could make an invention that'll make me rich and famous, maybe they'll let me in.
He was motivated.
Was he motivated, you know? So he went back to Boston, and he remembered thinking back to the times when he was meeting. The girl's name was Mabel. Do you remember when that thing of touching her throat and her touching his throat? Again, very politely, she'd have a prim, you know, the collar. They would just undo a button or two so they could touch the throat. And he remembered thinking, that moving membrane is what carried sound. And that gave him the idea for the telephone. Because when you speak into a telephone, this little moving membrane, it just shakes back and forth. And he just connected it by a wire to another membrane, which is in the earpiece of the phone of the person listening to you. And he just realized that the shaking in one, different sounds will make it shake in different ways, so the earpiece will shake in different ways. That was the invention of the telephone. And he went back to the island, and he said, well, he didn't have a chance to say anything because the girl was furious at her mother. She'd never written that letter. The mother just made it up, saying that the girl wasn't interested. What Mabel had actually said to her mother, I found the letter, she said, "Mother, just because I can't hear, does that mean I can't have the feelings of another young adult woman? Just because our family has great wealth, does that mean we can't trust anybody who I might meet who might care for me? Mother, give me a chance." Wasn't that something?
That is something.
And so then the mother let him in, and the couple did court.
Did she like him eventually?
Did she like him? She'd always wanted, when she got married, she'd always wanted, like, flowers. So they got married, and there were lilies and flowers there at the wedding. And he gave her a silver model of a telephone she wore around her neck. And he gave her about 1,246 shares of stock in a new company he was making, which is now worth several $1 billion kept in the family. Their first baby was born about 9 months and 1 minute later, you know, after the wedding. And they were married for 40 years.
That was called, by the way, a baby bell.
I had to do that. Anyways, but I didn't know what happened later. And there was a picture. He left telephones, and he became an inventor. And he invented one of those. What are those boats called that lift up on stilts? Hydrofoils, is that it?
Yeah, hydroplanes.
Yeah, he invented one of the first hydrofoils, hydroplanes. And in the 1920s, the one he developed had the world speed record. And there's a picture of him as an old man with a white beard and leaning on a cane on the dock in Nova Scotia. He moved up to Canada. And there's one of these hydrofoils just shooting across the water. It was all aluminum and silvery and streamlined to look like some science fiction thing out of the future.
Once an inventor, always an inventor, David.
An inventor. But you couldn't see Mabel in the picture. And I thought, oh, did she die? But I read the caption. You know why you couldn't see her?
Why?
She was piloting it.
We'll be back in a moment. Albert Einstein, he's next. Not as a guest. We're going to talk about it.
City of Angels, Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
My oh my oh my, we just had a 4.1 magnitude earthquake in the Pacific Ocean, and it is 18 miles from Santa Rosa Island in California. It is 54 miles from downtown Santa Barbara. It is 105 miles from Los Angeles. 4.1 magnitude. They call it a light earthquake in the Pacific Ocean. It just happened. Well, we're still selling a week to go after this. One more week after this, where I will officially announce the no longer the After Dark CD. So you can pick it up. You get a double CD, great bumper music, calls to the program, they're neat, and some really strange ghost stories. Go to this website, afterdarkcd.com. That's the best way to order it, afterdarkcd.com. There is a toll-free number. They're winding that down. 800-598-2331, 800-598-2331, or afterdarkcd.com. So, David, a long time ago in a far-off place, you wrote a book called E equals MC Square. How did you do that? Why?
Oh, that That was one of my favorite books. I had quit being a writer. I was a writer in the 80s and early 90s, mm-hmm. and I had a big bestseller in the mid-80s, and then I wrote some sequels that were so-so, stopped selling. So I quit. I changed careers. I thought, okay, I've had my innings at that, and I became a business consultant. But then one day, I was walking down the street in London, and it was just before a sunset on a winter's day in December. The sun was really low, almost blasting in my eyes, in that really crisp way it gets in winter. And suddenly I thought, there's five little symbols that everybody's heard of. E-M-C squared equals M-C squared, but most people don't know what it means. And what if, you know, if you found out that the secrets of the universe were this big, complex thing, like if you open up a computer and see there's this big, complex wiring inside, you say, okay, you know, complicated computer, complicated wiring. But to find out that one of the secrets of the universe is explicable by just five little symbols, I thought, wow, what if I could explain it? And then a week or two later, I was reading a copy, I think, of Premiere magazine, the movie magazine, and I saw an interview with Cameron Diaz, the actress, who I've always liked.
Oh, yeah,
and
she's good.
And in the interview, somebody said to her, is there anything else you'd like to know? And she said, yeah, what does equals MC squared mean? And apparently they laughed at her. And she said, no, I'd really like to know. And I thought, wow, she wants to know too. And I remember saying it to my friends and who were around. I said, do you think she really does? And they said, yeah. And I said, Dave, look, if anybody could make it clear, it's going to be you. So I thought, come on, that's my challenge.
Hey, you know, that's a great question in a lounge or a bar. What a pickup line, huh?
Yeah.
You go up to someone, and if they don't know it, you walk.
Yeah, right, if you don't know it. But with this book, and what happened is, you know, sometimes, I mean, I'm sure all your shows are good, but there must be some where you just realize it's clicking. You're in a groove, the guest is in a groove, maybe even the phone people phoning in. And like you said, maybe there's some sort of resonance going on across whatever is happening. It's all working. You know, you always do a good job, always professional, but sometimes it's really flying. And Electric Universe and also very much, but especially Equals MC Squared, it hit a button. It got published in one country, then another, then another. I think it's been published in 26 countries and like reached the top almost all over the place. And people, they come up to me and say, I always wondered what Einstein did. You know, you see a picture of, like, this man who suffered from these really bad hair days, and he's supposed to be the smartest man in the world. And you want to know, what did he do? Like, Edison, okay, he invented a telephone, or Henry Ford, you know, Steve Jobs, you think, okay, the iPod. I might not know exactly how it works inside, but I can kind of imagine. I see what it is. But what did Einstein do? Why somebody so smart, what did they come up with? So I think everybody was ready for me to tell the story.
Well, and I want to hear a little bit about that, but one thing that has always amazed me is what would have happened had Albert Einstein, with that brain, what would he have been able to accomplish with today's computers?
Well, I can give you a little hint. The not the top thing he invented, not the second, not the third, but about the 11th or 12th main thing he invented was a little paper he wrote in 1917 that explained how lasers could work, but nobody could build it then. And it was about... when were lasers? I think there were some simple ones in the 1950s, and they only really got going, you know, much later. You know, CDs work by lasers, DVDs work by lasers. The whole internet switching system does. So he predicted, but
he knew
how to build this in 1917.
All right, somebody should have grabbed that patent a long time ago, I guess.
Oh,
nobody picked it up. But I believe though, David, that if Albert Einstein was sitting down at some of these, even a desktop computer today. I mean, he's not going to be any smarter, but would he be able to do like his E equals MC2 equation, like in seconds? Because it must have taken him years.
It would be sort of a force multiplier. Well, it's interesting, your question, because sometimes having access to all sorts of other information speeds you up. But, you know, sometimes it slows you down. Have you ever been at, like, a dinner party where everybody's talking, or you come home and you're trying to run an idea through your head, but the kids are just, they're lovely and charming, but they're really busy, and you have to do this and that, and you don't have time to quietly think. And Einstein always used to say it was excellent to be able to take about 2 or 3 years to quietly think. He said if you spend too long on your own, you become sort of like a fruit pie. You know, you become, like, nutty. But if you spend no time on your own without quietly thinking, all the time, always, like the equivalent today, always surfing the net, always, you know, connecting them with chat groups and stuff, you don't have time to reflect on your own. There's an old story, Rabbi Hillel, 2,000 years ago, said that if there's a big fire burning and you take one of the pieces of wood and take it away from the fire, for a brief moment it'll just blast into flame brighter than all the rest of the fire because it gets all the fresh air around it. But if you wait, after a while it'll burn out, it'll become a dark ember while the main fire is still burning. So you need a little bit of time on your own, but then you have to have a good community. So I think Einstein's the sort of guy he would switch his cell phone off for a while. He would leave a message on his email saying he's away, and he'd go fishing for about. Actually, he liked boating, he'd go boating for about 3 or 4 weeks and then come back. So he liked a bit of quiet time plus connected time.
It re-energized him.
Yes, it really, really did.
Who was Albert Einstein?
He was a guy with a great, goofy sense of humor. His sister, his little sister, wrote a memoir later about what he was like as a kid.
Where was he born?
Well, there's all sorts of made-up stories about Einstein. So for the book, I went to the original sources and got some real ones. And he had a really nice temper as a kid. But one time, he was angry, and he threw a bowling ball at her and hit her in the head.
A huge bowling ball.
Yeah, and she didn't duck in time. And she wrote later, she said, and that shows it takes a thick skull to be the sister of a world-famous physicist. So his family had this sweet sense of humor.
Where were they from?
Oh, it was a Jewish family from Hamburg in the north of Germany.
Okay.
Originally, they were born elsewhere. And when he was a teenager, his father was an electrical contractor of street lighting and electrical motors, and he couldn't get any jobs because of anti-Semitism. So the family moved on to Italy, and Einstein loved it. He always loved learning new languages. As he said, he spoke them all badly with the same accent, and he fell in love. And, you know, to go at 16, to go to Italy is kind of nice.
At what time in his life did he leave Germany?
Well, when he was a teenager, his family went to Italy, and he followed them, and he liked parts. Germany now is like a single unified country.
Okay, so this wasn't a vacation. They just moved out.
They moved there. They were gone. And he liked parts of Germany, but parts of it, the strong Prussian military influence, he really hated. He hated when people would have rote learning and, you know, there was a lot of beating in the schools then, a lot of hitting and stuff. So he hated that. So after he spent some time with his family at age 16, he didn't go back to Germany. All by himself, he went to Switzerland. And he went to a small, he tried to get into university, and he failed his entry exams. So he went to a really, really good remedial high school in the valleys up in the north of Switzerland. And he fell in love again. He was very good at falling in love. We know him as a funny-looking old man, but when he was young, he was dishy. He was hot.
What did he like to do? He wasn't into sports.
He was surprisingly fit. Everybody remarked, you know, when he took his shirt off and stuff. He wasn't a weightlifter, but he was quite fit, and he really liked boating. He liked long walks and stuff. He was a quite good musician. The one time he was playing in a string quartet, and that guy he was playing with stopped, put down his violin, and said, "Einstein, can't you count?" You know, he got the timing.
I mean, what kind of jobs other than playing a little music here and there? What did he do?
Well, when he finally did get into university, and there, he just liked to think about where things came from. He was like that thing about, like, you know, iron filings and a magnet. You know, a magnet can pull iron filings around. Most of us look at it and say, okay, that's neat. But he began to think, wow, just like Faraday, are there these invisible force fields? Where do they come from? Where do they develop? Anyways, that sort of person is a really obnoxious student. When the professor is interested in him, you know, were interesting, he would pay attention. But the rest of the time, he'd go, ah.
He'd go out.
He did not have respect. He'd go to the coffee shops. But it came back to haunt him, because when it came time to get a job after university, everybody, there were six kids in his class, and the rest of them got jobs, but not him. You know, he couldn't get any letters of recommendation. So he ended up working in the patent office in Bern, Switzerland, and it was a bit of a problem, because there was a library in the town, but his only free day, you know, the unions weren't strong, so people worked 6 day weeks.
Yeah.
His only free day was Sunday, and the library was closed then. He said he used to have his Department of Theoretical Physics was the drawer on the top left of his desk, and whenever his supervisor would come by, Einstein would have to take the papers he was working on, push them in the drawer, and slam it shut, you know, closing his department, and go back to looking at the patents. But again, and the other thing is, remember I said that he was sort of dishy when he was young. There was one girl in his university physics class, and she was nice, very intense, dark haired from Eastern Europe, and he looked at her near the beginning, and he told his friends, "I'm going to get her. We're going to get married." And there were all these other guys in the class, but he courted her. And
they all laughed at him, right?
Excuse me?
They all laughed at him.
A little bit. People who didn't know him, Mike, but people who knew him well, he was charming. He had that sense of humor, sort of like his sister, always like these, you know, these sort of spinning roundabout jokes and stuff, you know, kind of shtick. And he was really charming. I found the love letters he wrote her, and they begin by saying, "Do you have the lecture notes on the advanced calculus request?" And then a few weeks later, it's like, "Oh, my dear, your black hair stretched over my arms when we were hugging together by the meadow." You know, it's like, whoa, he was a fast actor. And they actually had a great relationship for a little while. He was really hands-on dad. But the following thing happened.
I bet he was.
but he became famous. And when you're famous, people would come to the house, and so she was a good physics student, and he was a good physics student, and they would share taking care of the kids together. But people would come to the house, and they'd be all eager. They Einstein and his wife Mileva, they'd make little cakes and stuff, and have tea and coffee. It'd be all ready, and the people would come over, and they would talk to him, and she'd be kind of like interested, and then the baby would cry, and because he was being talked to, she would go and tend the baby, and then she would tend the baby and come back and try to join in the conversation again. But the conversation moved on, and so Einstein was really polite, and he would like bring her in again. But if the baby would cry again or there's something to do, she would leave again. And after two or three times of that, you give up. You're not going to try to get back in the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
So their relationship, it was really a shame. They really were in love for several years when they were first together. They had a buck against their family's directives to get together. His mother didn't want him to marry anybody, let alone this woman, and her family didn't want her to marry a Jewish man. And they'd had a child out of wedlock who they gave up for adoption.
Oh, they
so
did. Okay.
They were really bonded together.
When did he come up with the equation energy equals mass times the speed of light squared?
Yeah, it came up in 1905. He was hot that year because his mother had always thought he was a good student, and his sister had always liked him, and he had been promising. But when he was 21, he didn't come up with anything. 22, 23, 24, 25. And so in 1904, he was 25, still hadn't come up with anything. And he thought, ugh, maybe I'm, all talk and no action. But in 1905, when he was 26, it all started coming together in his mind. And he started clicking off these papers, boom, 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 one after another. And the final one he did in the autumn, he went to sleep one night. He said he had this most horrible headache. He felt his head was splitting. When he woke up in the morning, he said it was like a storm, an electric storm had cleared. And it was, that beautiful smell you get right after a storm?
Clean.
When it's all over?
It's that clean smell.
Yes, super clean. And he woke up and he said, it was totally clear in his head. So he wrote out his special theory of relativity, and a little bit later he wrote a little follow-up paper, and he realized that E equals MC squared. That's what he wrote. He used different symbols, but that's what it came out to be.
Now, what does it mean?
Suppose somebody came to Earth and had never seen fire, right? And suppose you took a log or a twig, a thick branch of a tree that was really wet, and you lit it, and they'd never seen fire, and they would see this incredible amount of smoke would come out of it. And they'd say, whoa, where did that come from? Well, it turns out Einstein was a little bit like that. He said that what the equation says is that mass can turn into energy. So right now I'm holding a pen in my hand. And what Einstein said is the mass of that pen, maybe it weighs a few ounces or whatever, that it holds within it an incredible amount of energy. And that you could actually get that energy to explode outwards. And it would be as if, again, we're not used to that, but just think of all the smoke that comes out of a wet twig when you burn it. Just it really billows out. And if you had never seen that, you'd be amazed it's all hidden inside there. So he said mass, it's kind of like a miser. The energy is inside there, but you never see it. A miser is a rich man, never lets the money out. But there's ways to release it, and he hoped it would never be released on planet Earth.
It scared him, didn't it?
Yeah, because it turns out if the equation just said M equals E, mass equals energy, that'd be kind of easy. A pen that weighs a few ounces, maybe it'd be,
It's a wash,
energy.
One for one, right?
Yeah, it'd be like, it's like burning a piece of paper, it flares up a bit, but it's not so bad, or
right.
Burning a log, one to one. But it turns out C squared is a great big number.
It's huge.
C is a big number, and C squared is an even bigger number. So what the equation's really saying is you take a little bit of mass, and you multiply it. You multiply it by like the mother of all numbers, this giant number. It's in the trillions in our units. And so a little bit of mass goes in, and what comes out is a fabulous amount of energy. Over Hiroshima in Japan in 1945, the bomb that the U.S. Air Corps dropped, the amount of uranium that was the mass that was destroyed was only just an ounce or two at most. But that turned into enough energy to destroy a whole city. In fact, it hit the moon and bounced back, the blast. Not the blast itself, but the light from it was hit the moon and bounced back in just a few seconds. It was an incredible thing, and that's just what's hidden inside a little bit of mass.
Was he responsible then for the atomic bomb because
it's
of that
funny.
Formula?
Right after the bomb was exploded, he didn't actually work on the engineering project, but his secretary, Helen Dukas was her name in Princeton, came up to him and said, look, Professor Einstein, I saw this in the papers. And he said, if I'd known that would have happened, I wouldn't have lifted a finger.
You mean so they kept him in the dark on this?
The FBI hated him. They said he was a security risk because he was a rare breed of in America. Now, he was a liberal Democrat, and the FBI did not like him. So they harassed him, and they wouldn't let him work on the Manhattan Project.
So he was totally in the dark about this until it exploded. He must have known something.
He had hints. And you know one of the greatest hints he had? That there were all these specialists, because he showed how theoretically it could happen, but then you need the practical engineering. You have to refine the uranium or refine the plutonium and put it together and get the charges, you know, all that sort of stuff. So suddenly all these scientists he had known were disappearing. Whoop. A specialist in explosives disappeared. A specialist in uranium disappeared. A specialist in atomic physics disappeared. So, you know, it's like you can put two and two together. So he knew that something was going on.
But it just didn't involve him. I wonder if he was curious.
You know, sometimes you know, but you don't want to know. It's almost like if there's a teenager with a drug problem, you know, you don't want to know too much.
When did he start getting involved in, like, time and, you know, whether going back into time or forward was possible?
That also began in that incredible year of 1905. He was just mulling when he was 26, and he was really hot for about 20 years. And between his hottest time was between about 26 and 36, between about 1905 and 1915. And he created these fabulous theories. I'm just overwhelmed. I know I've read a bit in the history of science, and most people, you know, the difference. Sometimes you see an athlete. And you accept that athlete is better than you. You know, there's no question. He can run faster than you, but you can kind of imagine being trained, and in theory, maybe you could do that, or maybe you could do that when you're younger or whatever. But sometimes you see an athlete and you say, no way, it's just magic. It's just, there's no way whatsoever I could possibly do that. And Einstein was like that. I've read about a lot of scientists, and I'm quite willing to, you know, I respect that they're much smarter than me, but I could always kind of imagine what they did and follow it and stuff. But Einstein was flying in a plane above, really above anybody else.
Well, he sure was. And you know what? When he died, this country, I think, lost one remarkable mind, don't you?
It was just special. The thing about time, according from his theories, you can't go back in time, but you can go forward in time at different rates. So you can actually make people go forward at different rates. So there's something called the Einstein rocket, where if you went into it, if you went into it and traveled very, very quickly in it, you might feel that only 10 minutes passed, but when you came back to Earth, the Earth would be 40 years. 40 years would have passed. Everybody you knew would be 40 years older.
What a horrible thing to come back to.
Isn't that, I mean, it's kind of scary.
It is. David, stay with us. We're going to take some phone calls when we come back. David Bodanis, our guest on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.
Let yourself help, he said, clear.